From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Dieter Roms. He's an architect and designer, and some of you won't know the name, but every one of you will have seen his work or used the products he designed, like your Apple stuff, your phones and tablets. They were inspired by Roms' philosophy of simplicity and functionality. Think of it like this: less but better. We're screening a film about Roms next week, talking about it. We'll be right back.
KUER's new project, The Hive Mind, puts you right in the newsroom with our reporters. Here's how it works. Look under the News and Programs tab at KUER.org, click on The Hive Mind, and you'll see what one of our reporters is working on. Maybe it's affordable housing or national parks fees. It changes. You tell us what you want to know, vote on other listeners' questions, and we'll try to figure it out. It's like this. The news is for you, and you should have some say in how we make it. Join The Hive Mind at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center, and we're talking about Dieter Roms. He's a German architect and designer, one of the icons of modern industrial design. Roms was head of the design team at the German electronics company Braun, or maybe you pronounce it Brown. They make coffee machines and men's shavers. And Roms was head of their design team for more than three decades. If you're a design geek like the filmmaker Gary Hustwit, you'll know his industrial designs. They're as familiar as an Eames chair or a George Nelson sofa. And even if you don't think you know Roms' work, his radios, his clocks, his furniture, all of that is going to seem familiar. Hustwit says they're brilliant in their simplicity and completely pared-down functionality. Roms famously drew up 10 principles. Good design, he said, is innovative. It's useful and understandable. And good design is as little design as possible. You can boil it down to this: less is better. And even though he was on the cutting edge of innovation, Hustwit's film shows how Roms is deeply troubled that digital technology and consumer culture is making people disconnected from each other. He says less is better is not only a design concept, it's also about our behavior. And that might be a theme in Gary Hustwit's documentaries. A number of them are about design. Hustwit is an independent filmmaker. His new film is called Roms, which we're screening next week. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. He joined us from a studio in Berlin, Germany. I've heard you talk about yourself as being a design geek. And I kind of wanted to start there. Your films, Helvetica and Objectified and Urbanized, and of course this one, and others. I mean, you're really interested in what is it about design, do you think, that interests you, that draws you?
I'm not entirely sure. I, in some ways, I think maybe I should have been a designer. Because I think after doing all these interviews with designers over the years, I do share a lot of the qualities that they do. But the thing that actually, you know, got me into design was the Macintosh, was the, you know, getting an early Macintosh computer and, you know, using some of the really rudimentary graphic design programs at the time, like PageMaker, to, you know, kind of do my own graphic design, or, you know, use the computer to, you know, make a poster for my friend's band playing or something like that. There was a real kind of democratization of design with the Macintosh. And that's what kind of, you know, got me interested in typography. I subsequently got involved in publishing books, so that kind of also kind of pushed me to learn a little bit more about how to use type. You know, it was kind of an independent press that I was running in California, and we could never afford to hire a real designer. So I kind of had to teach myself how to lay out the pages and you know, start kind of playing around with cover design. So I was never kind of a professional designer. I wouldn't call myself a designer, but I use type and graphic design for whatever projects I was doing, whether it was music or books, and then later getting into the web and into film. And then through typography, I started kind of learning about things like the Bauhaus and a lot of the kind of mm-hmm. early kind of avant-garde and modernist type designers, and which just got me involved in other fields of design, whether it was industrial design or furniture or architecture and, you know, kind of historical movements. So I never went to school for design, but it was just an interest in something that I got obsessed with.
It's interesting you said that you think you shared a lot of the characteristics with some of the designers that you've talked to over the years. I'm wondering in what are the things that you shared? I'm thinking of honesty and functionality and simplicity.
Probably not those things.
Are those some of the things?
No. I would say the main thing is questioning the status quo or just asking why. I think I'm really curious about things and just the world around me. And I'm just one of those people that just kind of questions why things are a certain way and then maybe thinks of ways that it could be better. And I think that's a trait that almost all of the designers that I've spoken with have. There is this constant push to kind of improve things incrementally, whether it's a product or a communication of some sort, or, you know, whatever they're working on. You know, whenever I'm looking at something, I'm constantly thinking like, how could it be better? Or why does it have to be that way? Why can't it be this other way? So I've found that every designer that I've talked to probably has that gene in them of questioning things and then kind of having the drive to try to change them in some way, in whatever way they can.
When did you first meet Dieter Rams? Was it when you were doing Objectified, your film?
Yeah, it was 10 years ago in 2008 when I interviewed him for Objectified. And I only basically spent one day with him here in Germany. And what was funny was, you know, I'd come all that way and I was really excited to talk about, you know, product design and his philosophies. And this was in the summer of 2008 in the kind of run up to the US elections. And all he wanted to talk about was Obama. He was obsessed with Obama and with the US elections. And he's very up to date on world affairs, even though he doesn't have a computer and, you know, is not on the internet. He's still incredibly well informed and thinks about these things. So it was something that kind of struck me, you know, going forward after I had put out the film. And yeah, and we just, you know, we hit it off. We had a really nice day. Luke Geisbühler, my cinematographer, and I just kind of, you know, we work really minimally. We don't have a ton of gear, and I think he appreciated that fact. I think he actually still talks about it 10 years later, how we were so low impact inside his home. And I, you know, he's really protective about his home and his, you know, his peace and quiet. So, he still talks about that, how we came in, we didn't have any lights. It was just the two of us, was really stripped down. And we had a great conversation. So, you know, that's probably why he allowed me to do this, the full film.
But at what point did you decide, Gary, that that you wanted to really focus on Rahm's life, that not just that he would be an element to other films talking about design and these kinds of things, but that he himself would be the focus? When did you decide that?
Yeah, I happened to run into Mark Adams, who runs Vitsu, which is the company that still produces Rahm's furniture designs. And I just sort of assumed that someone would be making a, you know, comprehensive documentary about Dieter. And I asked Mark about it. And, you know, Mark's response was, no one, Dieter does not want to do it. He's tired of interviews. He doesn't want to talk to the media. He, you know, feels like he's told all the stories in books already and he's done. And my response to that was that, you know, a film can do different things than a book can. You can tell different stories and, expose this, this person's work and their philosophies to, I think, a much wider audience with the documentary. And this idea of kind of passing down his knowledge and his philosophy to another generation, which is really important to him, I think was what sort of pushed him to finally agree. And the memories that, that we were easy to work with and wouldn't destroy right. his house when we were spending weeks there.
The you feature in the film Sophie Lavelle, who's written about Dieter Rams, and she talks about what it's like to what it's like in his house, like what his life is like. He's notoriously private, mm-hmm. And I wanted to play a moment from this film and just talk to you a little bit about what it's like to sort of step into his space, which we, get to see in the film. But let me play this moment from Sophie Lavelle from the film, Rams.
He keeps himself in a very tranquil bubble. I mean, he's lived in the same house for almost 50 years. He hasn't moved. He goes, he gives talks, he gives lectures, he travels, there's shows about his work, he talks to people, he's very generous with his time, but he doesn't have hobbies. His work is his life's his work, and he's not really interested in anything else.
So what was it like being there with him in his space? Was he guarded? Was he, I mean, you got a sense that he was, as Sophie says, he's really generous, but he also seems very guarded about his space.
Well, I mean, walking into the house is sort of like walking into his brain or something. Everything in the house is either something that he designed or that he knows the designers of, or some kind of iconic piece of design that has influenced him. I think people, when they see pictures of it or when they see the film, think it looks like a museum. I mean, it's really minimal and it's really stripped down. But that's their home. I mean, that's how they live, and it's a they've been there for 50 years. It's just this idea of like the modern design and the modern home. In the film, there's also some archival footage of him in the house in the 1970s. And it looks exactly the same. It's identical, which is fun, which I think makes sense for him. Like, why do you need another table if you have a table that works well and that you like the design of? Or, why do we feel like we need to kind of change everything every few years or buy something that we know is going to wear out in 5 or 10 years? Like, his sofa is he's had the same sofa for 50 years now, and it'll outlive us probably. So I think the house is kind of an example of his thinking, this idea of less but better, which is kind of his his mantra. It's like he knows he's going to keep those things for the rest of his life. He helped design them and design them to last a lifetime. And why would you need to buy another bookshelf? You have one that will last 100 years or longer, and that it's modular and can be reconfigured. So, why would you buy the same cheap bookshelf from IKEA 5 times over your lifetime because it falls apart or you get sick of it?
He says in the film that you cannot understand good design if you don't understand people. And this is a kind of a theme in the film, this kind of social aspect of the way he sees his work. Mm-hmm. And there's that initial scene where he talks about how designers need to be sober but alert and rational and take notice.
Sure.
Talk a little bit about that idea that this is about people, about connection.
Well, I mean, I think if you look back to his, start in design in the 1950s, it's in the aftermath of World War II. There's this idea of sort of rebuilding Germany and rebuilding Europe and trying to kind of invent a new way of living and sort of sweep away the carnage of the war. You know, he was part of that generation. I think he was 13 when World War II ended. So, you know, he kind of saw the damage it had done and just wanted to, you know, make a better society. So even things as simple as designing a radio or a coffee maker or, you know, these really utilitarian products that Brown was making, it was about kind of trying to make democratic, well-made, honest products that people could have for a lifetime. I mean, there was a scarcity there. No one had anything at that point. So I think they were trying to kind of both reinvent society, but just make things that were usable and try to you know, make them in a different way. So I think he always kind of thought about design in that framework. But it's, you know, designers are creating the things that we experience all day long, from the doorknob that you put your hand on to open a door to, you know, everything around you has been designed. So this idea that it's sort of the first line in, you know, your experience in life is this, all this work of designers and what you choose to, you know, have around you, the objects that you choose to buy and to keep or to throw away. You know, that's all influenced by designers. So they do play a really kind of critical role in our day-to-day experience. And you know, he always talks about, like, design is politics. You know, this idea of equitable distribution of resources and taking care of the environment and taking care of people through design, I think, is something that he really believes in.
It's this really interesting moment in the film when he's talking about when he first managed to get enrolled in a technical arts college, this kind of mini Bauhaus. And he mentions how he liked how they had to make things from scratch. And then he said, and then above all, they had to clear up the mess.
Yeah.
which I thought was really great. And this idea of design also being, you know, about politics is something that Sophie Lovell mentions in the film. And again, putting it in the context of all of this coming after the war, trying to rebuild Germany. Here's Sophie Lovell again from the film.
Something that's actually not talked about much is that design is also politics. Although they didn't really talk about it in that way, him and his fellow students were very passionate about creating a world that was a better place and much more democratic. You know, they just come out of the shadow of this terrible time in history, and there was a lot of talk about design to give people freedom.
Yeah, the idea of freedom, that the whole... It was so social, his ideas about design. Seems like a theme in his work, and it seems like a theme you really focused on in the film.
Well, I mean, and you mentioned it, that the idea of clearing away the mess, and I think that did have a direct impact on how things looked. You know, they wanted this kind of, like, clean lines and this kind of a clean aesthetic. And this idea that products should kind of be in the background. They shouldn't draw attention to themselves. They're like tools. And then they should, you know, be unobtrusive. And it's, you know, it's not about the bookshelf. It's about the books or the things that you want to put on it and that matter, not the piece of furniture or the object itself. So, you know, that's a philosophy that, you know, kind of stretches through all his work.
You mentioned... his relationship with his grandparents, his grandfather in particular. I mean, it seems like he was a child of the war, he talks about, and it was a time when his parents were breaking up, and so he spent a lot of time with his grandparents, and his grandfather was this master carpenter. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how his workshop, Dieter Rams talks about how his grandfather's workshop was a refuge for him, and how his grandfather hated machines.
Yeah.
It seems like he's very much like his grandfather in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, carpentry was something that he got involved in very early on. And, you know, I think that the idea of building, whether it's, you know, a cabinet or a building, was something that stuck with him and pushed him to, you know, get enrolled in art school and eventually, you know, train in architecture. I mean, he really wanted to be a landscape architect or a urban planner. That was his goal. But, he applied at Brown on just a lark, from a dare from a friend, because they were looking for architects. But he quickly got kind of steered into product design by the Brown brothers and the management there, because they recognized that his talent and his drive and put him into product design. So he really didn't want to be a product designer. It wasn't something that he planned on, but that was just the way it worked out.
And he was really good at it. And I guess he kind of fell in love with it. I mean, the process, the idea of collaboration with these other designers. It's one of the things that we see early on in the film. There's this, he's talking to a student, a student's question about how can he resist mediocrity in his work. The student says, you know, how do I keep from being mediocre? And he says to him, Dieter-Rams says to him, you need to find people who can achieve something through collaboration. And that seemed important too. That seemed like something he was reemphasizing time and time again. This isn't just me.
Yeah.
This is me in relationship to other people designing this, doing this together, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think this myth of the genius, you know, hero designer who, you know, these ideas spring from their head and then, you know, they make them so, is a myth. You know, Rams talks a lot about his team and, you know, all the work that everyone from the engineers to the other design team members to students to, you know, a whole cast of collaborators for every project. But I think in the media, definitely in the kind of 60s and 70s, there was this sort of push to have him be the figurehead, you know, the handsome German guy driving a Porsche 911 and living this new lifestyle. So he, you know, I think kind of reluctantly did it because he's not, you know, he's not the kind of person that wants to draw attention to themselves and, you know. But he, you know, he was the figurehead and he kind of, you know, wanted to help, Brown, but that's, you know, that resulted in kind of a lot of misconceptions in terms of like, you know, everything there is a Dieter-Rams design. It's gotten to the point now where, yeah, if you have any Braun appliance, you basically, you know, think it's a Dieter-Rams design or like a vintage object in the same way that, if you search on eBay for Eames, you're going to come up with a million things that are not by the Eames, but are that era or that ideology or that design philosophy. And the same is the true with Rams. You know, he's identified as the, you know, this minimal, you know, functionalist designer who did everything. But of course, that's not the reality of it.
That's Gary Hustwit. He directed the documentary film Rams about the industrial designer Dieter-Rams, which we're going to be screening next Wednesday at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. This is part of our Through the Lens series. It's our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Gary Hustwit is going to be there for a Q&A after the film, so you'll want to join us and check out our website, radiowest.org, for the details. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. KUER.
KUER teams up with local and national businesses around the state to support the station and bring you Utah stories and national news from NPR. If you've got a business, like a restaurant or a car repair shop, or maybe you take wedding photos or offer legal services, whatever it is, when you join KUER as a business sponsor, you're helping people who care deeply about facts and storytelling stay connected to their community, all while building your company's brand. Learn more about becoming a sponsor at KUER.org.
This is Radio Westenberg for Brizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the latest documentary in our film series. Next week, we're going to be screening Gary Hustwit's film called Roms. It's about Dieter Roms. He's a designer, and some of you don't know his name, but every one of you will have used his work or seen his work, the products that he designed. They were inspired by this philosophy of simplicity and functionality. And you could boil it down to this: less, but better. Dieter Roms has these, he developed these 10 principles for design, and you go through them in the film. But what's interesting is you also talk about how, I've heard you say that you used the principles to design the film itself, and I wanted you to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think his 10 principles, I think, are very adaptable to other areas, whether they're, you know, design or not design, even filmmaking and just living, basically. So it was a constant, you know, kind of influence as we were editing the film. Kayla Sklar, the editor on the project, was, you know, had them taped up, you know, next to her desk while she was, you know, working on the film every day. So, you know, these ideas of simplicity and clarity and honesty, and you know, the final principle of his 10 principles is good design is as little design as possible. So I think we kept thinking about, you know, good filmmaking is as little filmmaking as possible. You know, this idea of not trying to make it obvious to the viewer that, like, you are watching a documentary film, versus just you're experiencing this person talking to you and being part of their life and learning about, you know, what they've done. So, you know, it was definitely kind of an impact. My takeaway, though, on the 10 principles is slightly different, because you know, I think they're you know, like I said, they're very adaptable, and I think they made sense for Dieter's team when they came up with them. But I think my takeaway has been not specifically his principles, but this idea of having a set of principles that we all should maybe kind of try to write down our 3 or 5 or 10 things that we think are good, or the type of work that we want to do, or the sort of people that we don't want to work with. Just kind of having a set of written out values, I think, is actually, it's a really positive exercise just trying to write those out. You can really start to kind of drill down to what your feelings are about how to live and how to work. And I think it's really important that we all maybe try to do that now. So I haven't done my, like, 5 principles of good filmmaking or whatever, but this idea of just trying to kind of lay down what you believe in, or what you believe is good. And then you've got a framework to judge the things that are not good in your opinion, rather than just being arbitrary. Yeah. You're like, I don't like this, I don't like this. Dieter in the film talks about other designers' work in a very frank and maybe not flattering way, but he has a framework to judge that work, and he can say why he thinks it's bad design. And I think that's kind of refreshing. Too often, I think we think we're being rude telling somebody why they're doing something that's wrong. But again, if you've got a framework and you got a list of things that you think are the right way, well, then you can kind of, you know, refer to that and base your judgments off that.
I think that's a really important idea in the film. And it's this idea that we cannot, as Matteo Kreis, the director of the Vitra Design Museum, mentions in the film. And I wanted to play this moment where he talks about how how Roms is from a generation where they just said what they thought was good. They had, as you said, those principles in mind. And so they could express what works for them, what doesn't, what's good and what's bad. They weren't trying to be relative about things. And in this moment from the film, Matteo Kreis talks about how, as he says, as you'll hear, we can't afford to be indifferent. Let me play this moment.
He's very clear about the people he likes. He's also from that generation where designers dared to say, this, to my opinion, is bad design. Today you would more often hear, this is interesting, you know. And you never know, what does that mean? Interesting, yes, of course. I think the whole world is interesting. But I'm currently thinking, asking myself whether we're not entering a time where this question, is it good or not good, is maybe becoming more important again. We just can't afford to be so indifferent.
And you show him, Gary, being critical. She said being critical of certain designers, mentioning things that he likes, certain things that he doesn't quite like. I liked that moment. I thought how honest he was, and it made me actually also wonder just whether that made you even more nervous as to whether or not he was going to like your film or the vision that you captured of him.
Yeah, he doesn't watch a lot of media, and I don't know how you would watch a film about yourself like this. I can't imagine what that would feel like. But he recognizes also that the film is my design. I mean, it's my work that I'm putting out. Yes, it's about him, but it's still like a project that I'm creating, and that like he trusts me on that, and I think he feels that it's getting his ideas and his message and his philosophies out there. I think another reason that he agreed to do the film was, he's been talking about these things like sustainability and environmental consciousness and just throwaway culture for 40 years now. And I don't think he felt like anyone was listening, or very few people in, and only within the design world were maybe listening. So, I think the reason that he's, likes the film is that he thinks it will help kind of get the message out there and hopefully, change people's lives a little bit.
I want to come back to that idea of these big systems that he has in mind that he wants to design, remake the world, mm-hmm. or rethink. I mean, really big ideas. But this idea of him being so clear, so precise in the way he designed things, this really comes out in the film. And what I love about it is we get to see the objects that he designed. And you really break down a couple of these objects, which is terrific. And I'm just thinking of a moment when he's talking with Mark Adams, the managing director, as you mentioned, of Witzo, who's, still doing some of his furniture. And Adam asks him in the film, he said, hey, should we offer this particular chair in cloth? Which is such a specific kind of question. And Dieter is really adamant that they shouldn't. And he talks about how they should speak the same language. And I thought that was such an interesting moment in the film, how precise he was, how he has this idea in mind. I just wanted to ask you about mm-hmm. that, just this uncompromising mm-hmm. idea that he seems to have.
Well, I mean, I think there's an aesthetic or a philosophy that he's, employed on all the products that he's been involved with, which is over 500 different objects. And there is a sensibility there that flows through. That, it's like once you learn the language of Dieter Rahm's designs, you can spot it in a second, because I think there is like an aesthetic and a purpose and a functionality to his work and the projects that he's been involved in that is very unique. And I think a lot of the decisions, like I don't know, the cloth versus leather kind of decision, I think maybe just be mostly founded on longevity, on that, in general, leather is probably going to last longer. I don't know. Yeah. But I think that there is a sensibility that follows through from the smallest, he designed the watch. And something we don't really get into in the film is that Rahms was one of the designers of the first Oral-B, you know, toothbrushes. So, you know, when Gillette bought Braun, he ended up working a lot on kind of Gillette or Procter & Gamble projects too. So, you know, he's designed from a toothbrush to, you know, just all these kind of larger furniture items and everything in between, the electronics and the stereos and the radios and the coffee makers and the juicers and all this stuff. There's a thread that runs through it all, that is just about his ideals and his philosophies about design and about how to live. What's interesting, I think, about Dieter and really kind of one of the main reasons I wanted to do the film, was that now he looks back on this, you know, lifetime of design work and kind of regrets it, because he feels like he's just kind of been a part of this system now that, you know, which began again very kind of idealistically after World War II, trying to make, you know, great products that would last, and has kind of spiraled out of control into, you know, this over-consumerized world of cheapness, basically. So, so I think that he feels, I don't think he feels responsible for it, but I think he feels that his work and the kind of, I don't know, desire that some of the electronics items that he designed have had, he's somehow been complicit in getting to where we are now.
He talks about, eventually he left Braun. They gave him this big useless title, and he finally leaves in 1997. Mm-hmm. And you know, he talked about going through all these different CEOs and how really none of the management were standing up for him. Mm-hmm. He said that's what you really need as a designer, as the leaders. And the early Braun brothers were, of course, they were absolutely with him and supportive of all these design concepts. Yep. And it just made me wonder, how does this kind of design work in his kind of design, work in a big consumer culture? I mean, Gillette, obviously, they want to keep growing, making more sales. So they start turning to marketing is the thing that's driving design, as opposed to utility, which is driving design. And that's something that Rahms just can't abide.
Yeah.
Just didn't fit. And I just wonder where he fits in the, where he thinks he fits in the current, you know, market.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, this idea of redesigning the same thing over and over again, just because, you know, you need a new product that year, is something that Rahms hates. I mean, it's a big kind of reason that, you know, there is so much kind of redundancy in the product market. So he's, you know, totally against that. But it's hard to fight that. It's hard to fight against, a system that is dependent on us continuing to buy stuff every year, sometimes the same things over and over again, because some, you know, little thing has changed, or it's styled a little differently, or whatever, or it's designed to break or to be obsolete so that we need to buy it again. And yeah, I mean, obviously that's a system that he's completely against. But unless there is sort of top-down design-driven ownership and management of a company, it's impossible to break that cycle, I think. I mean, he often talks about how lucky he was that the Braun brothers were, you know, designers and engineers at heart. And they gave a lot of trust to the design team to kind of determine what the new products should be and how to make them. And, you know, he was made the head of design there at 29 years old. That would just be unheard of today. So, you know, I think he realizes that it was a kind of a unique situation that doesn't happen all the time. And he often talks about the relationship of Steve Jobs and Jonathan Ive when Jobs is still alive at Apple, as kind of a similar situation where you had a CEO who was really a designer at heart and had enough trust in the design talent there to let them make the decisions and really make the lead. You know, has that changed since Steve Jobs has passed away? You know, you can be the judge.
There's a kind of a lovely moment in the film where you are exploring Dieter Rahm's influence over the Japanese designer Naoto Fukasawa. And in the film, somebody hands him a brown T3 radio. That this is the one that Dieter designed in, I think it was 1958. And Fukasawa seems just genuinely touched and moved by the experience of being able to touch this object that he had heard so much about and seen photos of for himself. I just wanted you to talk about that scene because I really loved it, where he's just talking about, Fukasawa was talking about how it's just this kind of perfect, complete design.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot going on there. Yeah. One is that, Dieter Rams was very influenced by Japanese culture and Japanese art and the kind of simplicity of it. And that informed a lot of his kind of early design work. Those designs ended up in the 60s kind of being exported around the world, including to Japan, where his kind of philosophies and those products influenced a whole generation of Japanese product designers like Naoto Fukasawa, who then, does a lot of design for companies like Muji. Mm. So when you see these products coming back to the West from Muji and this aesthetic, you might think it's sort of Japanese minimalism, but it's really European modernism kind of filtered through Japan and coming back in this new way. So Fukasawa was part of that generation that was influenced by Rahm's design. And if you look at the T3 pocket radio, it's just this very, very simple slab of white plastic with some speaker holes and a scroll wheel that it looks a lot like the kind of initial iPod scroll wheel, but just the simplicity to it, I think, and the calmness to it. You know, it doesn't have a huge logo that's screaming the name of the company, and it doesn't have flashy colors. It's just this really muted kind of, off-white. And it just there's a lot kind of built into that. The statement of making a radio like that in 1958, I mean, it still looks like the future when you look at it now. But in 1958, it was shocking. I mean, consumers weren't actually ready for these products. Right. They were not hugely successful in their day. It's only later that they've been kind of so influential and so sought after. But at the time, they just, looked like they were from another planet or something. I think that was a moment, because some of these objects are so rare now that you just don't get a chance to actually hold them. And you see a lot of photographs of them, but it's different when you kind of experience it in person.
Let me play one more moment from the film. This is Mark Adams, again, of Vitso. And he's talking about, because I want to ask you the question of why it is Dieter Rahm's work seems to be emerging so much now. Because it seems like his ideas are really catching on again in ways. I mean, they seem to have fallen by the wayside for a time, but they really seem to be emerging with this, maybe this new generation of designers. And there's this, it's a kind of a thing that Mark Adams in this moment from the film raises.
Dieter's a man with incredible sensitivity and understanding and appreciation of the natural world. In the 1970s, he was one of the early voices saying, what are we doing to our planet? And he woke up sort of mid-70s and went, whoa, am I part of the problem? I'm making all of this injection-molded plastic stuff. And that was where the 10 principles for good design came from, because he was questioning himself, saying, whoa, actually, are we producing something that is adding value to the planet, that is not just depleting the resources? The challenge is how we can take Dieter's very strongly held belief forward in another generation.
It seems like I wanted to ask you about that. It seems like his idea, somebody asks him about why he didn't want to do much with the automotive industry. And, you know, he just talked about how they were more interested in speed. He said it's not about the tech. Seems like he's talking about it's not about the car itself. It's the system. And it seems like mm-hmm. that's what he's thinking about these days, not just the one piece of technology, but bigger systems that we need to rethink, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he sees it just as the complacency, I think, and getting into this groove of just, you know, offering, you know, what color's the hairdryer going to be this year, or, you know, whatever the product is. And not really thinking bigger picture in terms of what we actually need, you know, to survive. And transportation is one that he talks about a lot. You know, it's not about electric cars or, you know, these kind of, you know, small steps. It's about trying to rethink transportation as a system and think about what we really need. In terms of you know, getting around and how to rethink that. I mean, he's just always kind of tried to think on a kind of more revolutionary level. And I think that's why, you know, after, you know, years of kind of having to do the same thing over and over again at when Gillette bought Brown, that he finally kind of called it quits. But what's, I think, interesting to me is that, you know, he spent 40 years basically kind of obsessing over how we use these devices and interact with them. And then, you know, he left Brown in the mid 90s, just when digital was kind of, you know, on the rise and the internet and, you know, smartphones. So he kind of opted out of design at that moment and has been just sort of watching over the past, you know, 20 so years of how this technology has changed our behavior. And I think he's kind of horrified by it. And you know, I think one kind of theme in the film, it's not anti-digital technology, but it's trying to, this, you know, idea of rethinking, like, is this really a direction that we want to keep going in? Yeah. And trying to kind of just take a breath and look at how this technology is affecting our daily behavior and our kids' behavior, and maybe try to rethink it a little bit, and not just so, you know, just going down the you know, the digital path so blindly. So I think that's, you know, another of his big concerns. But I think there are a lot of things that we need to be concerned about these days, not just our phones.
Let me ask you finally, I know we're out of time here. It's expressed so beautifully in a scene where he's in London and he's just sort of surrounded by these crowds, and it just made me wonder where he fits these days. I mean, he talks about being worried that people don't actually look at each other in the eyes, that when they take a photo, it's not, there's no trace of it left in their minds. We're just sort of outsourcing these emotions. And I just wondered where a person like that fits ultimately these days.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he fits in his backyard with his bonsai trees that he, you know, trims and just as a thinker, and hopefully, again, someone who can kind of affect the thinking of not only designers, but, you know, the consumers of all this design and all these products. It's interesting. If you say the word consumers to Dieter, he takes objection to it and gets angry because he thinks it means to, like, use something up and throw it away. And he prefers the term users when he talks about these things, because products and you know, just kind of everything around us, the resources should be used and then passed on, and not just consumed and disposed of. So, you know, I'm not sure what his place is, but he's someone that I think has influenced so much of the world around us, I mean, I grew up with a Braun coffee maker in my house and a juicer, and, you know, my dad had a Braun razor, and, you know, all these little things have contributed to our experiences. And I think that he still has some, you know, pretty profound ideas about the future. And, you know, I'm hoping that the film can just get those out there into the conversation a little bit more.
That's the director Gary Hustwit talking about his film Roms, about the industrial designer Dieter Roms. We're going to be screening the film next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Gary Hustwit will join us for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.